I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A new book looks at the life of Paul Martin Sr. No, not the guy that was Prime Minister before Harper and after Chrétien. Paul Martin Sr. was that guy's dad. The book is called Grit, The Life and Politics of Paul Martin Sr. It's a full-length biography of the Liberal MP from Windsor, Ontario, who served in the House of Commons from 1935 to 1968. He was appointed to the Senate in 1968 by Pierre Trudeau, where he served until 1974. Martin served in the cabinets of William Lyon Mackenzie King, Louis Saint-Laurent, Lester Pearson, and Pierre Trudeau. He ran for the leadership of the Liberal Party three times, 1948, 1958, and 1968, and lost each time. Perhaps that's why he's forgotten, but his accomplishments as a cabinet minister are remarkable and are all discussed in this new book. Its author, Greg Donaghy, joins me now. He's written a great biography that looks at this remarkable figure in Canadian political history. It also gives us some insight into the Liberal Party of Canada and those years where Martin was a significant player on the federal scene. I'll get Mr. Donaghy to tell us about this book, as well why we need to know about Paul Martin Sr. This book is part of the C.D. Howe series in Canadian political history, which is published by UBC Press. The series of books, edited by Robert Bothwell and John English, will provide fresh perspectives on Canadian political history and public policy. This book is a great place to start. Greg Donaghy is head of the historical section and deputy director of the Policy Research Division at Foreign Affairs and International Trade Canada. He was educated at the University of Toronto, Carleton, and the University of Waterloo. He has authored and edited numerous scholarly articles. A previous book includes Tolerant Allies, Canada and the United States, 1963 to 68. He is the recipient of the Diamond Jubilee Medal and the Medal of Freedom from the Hungarian government. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto, Greg Donaghy. Dr. Donaghy, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you work at Foreign Affairs Canada.
I do work there.
Yeah, I guess.
But I hasten to add that this is not an official publication of the Government of Canada.
That's correct, yes. So just a question about that department. I guess Mr. Nicholson, he's the minister now, is that right?
He is the minister, yeah.
Yeah. In Paul Martin's senior's time, he was titled Minister of External Affairs.
Well, no, he was actually, his title, which was derived from the British title, was Secretary of State for External Affairs.
I see. And then when did we start calling it Minister of Foreign Affairs?
We started, I think it was under the, when Lloyd Axworthy became Minister in the 1990s.
So that's
so
like,
it's a yeah. recent innovation. And the term External Affairs is really rooted in the department was created in 1909. They were looking for a name that would cover the idea that the department would look after Canada's relations outside the country, externally, but not Canada's foreign relations, which at the time, of course, were handled by Great Britain.
I see.
And they remained like that until 1931. And when Jean Chrétien became Prime Minister in 1993, they decided that it was time to kind of modernize the title and have it reflect the fact that we now were a fully grown and mature country that took care of its own foreign relations, and we had, in fact, been doing so for 60 or 70 years by that point.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those titles from the past that you know, we read about. I mean, I'm 33, but I remember hearing about it in the news, say, in the 80s and 90s,
mm-hmm.
and then it just disappeared one day, and
yeah,
here we are.
Yeah, as I say, it was rooted in the British practice and in the kind of discussions around the mandate of the very original Department of External Affairs in 1909.
So on Paul Martin Sr.'s legacy, I mean, how is he viewed heretofore?
Well, I got involved when I first kind of encountered Martin in a serious way was grad school, and when I started as a very young historian with the Department of External Affairs, as it was then known, and retired ambassadors would kind of come up to me and say, you know, you're working on Paul Martin and NATO or Paul Martin and Vietnam. Well, you know, I tell you, he was a politician, and that drove his foreign policy. And it struck me that there might be a little bit more there. And so, as I, you know, that's what kind of led me. I encountered Martin then with my PhD work, and, you know, he was a much more complicated and complex man. And he was certainly a politician, but, you know, I thought that he was a very principled, he had some strong principles about foreign policy and strong hopes about foreign policy. And, you know, the trick of political leadership in a democracy is to marry the two, the kind of the popular will and the, you know, and your principles. So bringing together, you know, that 50% plus one or more, if you can manage it, in pursuit of what you define as the national interest.
And so he did that. He married policy and politics, and that was his career, essentially, for all those years that he was in Ottawa.
Well, I mean, so he was a very political minister.
Yeah.
as Secretary of State for External Affairs. He had strong and legitimate political ambitions. That's the way our system works. Ministers, backbenchers go and prove themselves, and then they get elevated to cabinet, and then they prove themselves in cabinet. And if all the stars align and they're good, then they have a shot at becoming prime minister. And so that, in part, certainly drove Paul Martin. But he, you know, he was a strong believer in the international rule of law. He was a strong proponent of kind of post-war liberal internationalism, strong backer of the United Nations, collective security through NATO. And he worked tirelessly to kind of strengthen those organizations while he was foreign minister in the 1960s.
So let's go to the beginning of his life. His mother, Lumina, what sort of effect did she have in terms of how he formed himself and in terms of his political thinking, if you will?
Well, I mean, she was huge in several different ways, in large part because one of the kind of crucial defining events in Paul Martin's life was a bout of polio he suffered as a very young toddler, which really meant that two things. One, he was confined at home as a toddler and as a young child, up until his early teen years. He was very much kind of a homeboy, which meant that his mother had a tremendous impact on him. And she had an impact in two ways. One was her faith, and obviously she was a devout Catholic, and Martin kind of absorbed that Catholicism and that devoutness, which when you consider his treatment for polio really involved the pilgrimage to St. Anne to St. Joseph's Oratory in Montreal. So there was a kind of a, you know, kind of a immediate evidence of the importance of divine intervention at play already in Paul Martin's life as a child. And the other thing that he absorbed from her was a real strong sense of ambition, you know, a need to get on, a desire to get on, to make good in the world. So those two things, his faith and his ambition, I think you can trace right back to Lumina.
And so his Catholicism, even in his later years, I mean, that remained devout, that remained strong?
He remained, he remained an active practicing Catholic right through his entire life. He was, and, you know, the Catholicism really, you know, these things get formed when you're in your teens and your early 20s, and it was a crucial kind of period in kind of the evolution of the 20th century Catholic Church. It was a time when there were huge gusts of, in the late 19-teens, early 1920s, huge gusts of kind of experimental thoughts around how the Church was going to tackle problems of modern society in a way that didn't kind of give way to kind of a strong authoritarian state, either of the left and the right, but somehow reined in the excesses of free market capitalism. You know, this is the gilded era of, you know, around the First World War and the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers. And you know, so how were we going to get people out of tenements, out of ghettos, into good, solid, steady jobs? And so all of that was at play when Martin arrived at St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto in 1920-21. And, you know, he just absorbed that kind of Catholic experimentation or small-L liberal Catholicism as part of his makeup. And it really did, it defined his outlook on society and its problems for all of his life.
And then the evolution of Catholicism, or the, say the reforms, if you will, of Catholicism, say in the 60s, Vatican II especially, that interested him a great deal. Did that influence him at all in his faith?
It interested him a great deal, and he read a number of the theologians of the time, and he was a participant in many of the kind of discussions that were going on in the church. He was not a convert. One of his early influences was Cardinal Newman, and Cardinal Newman was a very, very, in addition to being a kind of a social liberal, he was kind of all over the map, but he was kind of a theological conservative. So he was very careful about adopting radical changes in a hurry. And you know, Martin used to say that, you know, no generation has the right to cast judgment on another generation or on the traditions of another generation. So he was, you know, much of the changes around Vatican II he welcomed, but at the same time, there was a certain uneasiness there. But you have to remember, you know, by that time, he was a guy in his early 60s, so it's not entirely surprising that he was a little more cautious than he was 40 years earlier.
Yeah, and so when you look at the span of his life, and as you have in the course of writing this book, do you figure out why politics for him, and why at such an early age?
Well, I think that's really revolves around his ambition and his faith. I mean, his mom used to preach that there were three vocations in life: the religious vocation, a political vocation, or teaching. And you know, Martin became, you know, he saw that he saw politics really as a vocation. You know, and in the Catholic religion, a vocation is a calling from God. So it's you know, so here you have this guy that was healed by God, healed at the St. Joseph's Oratory. His mother always said that it's St. André Bissonnette who made Paul Martin walk. So, you know, there's this divine intervention in his life, and his mom is preaching this idea that, you know, politics is a calling from God. And so, you know, so his faith, I think, led him very early on into kind of embracing that career. Now, you combine that with her emphasis, Lumina's emphasis on the importance of ambition and getting ahead in this world as well as the next, and it's kind of, you know, in many ways it's logical that you could see that Martin would be drawn into this kind of a career.
And then how long, once elected the MP for Windsor, did he make it into the cabinet?
Now, he was elected in 1935. Mm-hmm. He didn't make it into the cabinet until 1945. It was a long haul for him to get into the cabinet, I think in part because, you know, he was a pretty, you know, people talk about him. Here's again, you kind of, the view we have of the older Paul Martin as this kind of Windsor Ward Hill, or a smooth old Paul on the make, willing to compromise and do whatever it takes to get ahead. But in actual fact, if you look at his behavior in the 1930s as a young politician, you know, he was ready to defy his leader, his prime minister, on matters of principle, and he did so on a couple of times. He never went so far as to kind of resign or anything like that. But, you know, the prime minister warned him off too close in association with Mitch Hepburn, the Ontario Liberal leader. And, you know, Paul Martin disregarded that warning, for instance. Paul Martin was active in the early 1930s. There was a reform movement afoot within the Liberal Party, and Paul Martin was active in that, you know, kind of rethinking the Liberal Party platform to deal with the Depression of the 1930s. Again, this was not an activity that the Prime Minister wanted to see him involved in. He was active as a on the international scene, and you know, on one notable occasion, he kind of was critical of a speech the Prime Minister was to give, and that drew the Prime Minister's wrath. So there was, You know, he was a principled and courageous politician who drew the ire of the prime minister in the mid-1930s, and he spent the next 4 or 5 years kind of proving his loyalty over and over and over again. And it wasn't until Mackenzie King was certain that Paul Martin was on board on board his boat that he appointed him to cabinet.
Yeah, and the relationship with Saint Laurent, what was that like?
Well, Martin had, I mean, Martin was promoted then in, he joined the cabinet in 1945 as Secretary of State, which is a pretty junior portfolio, and then was eventually promoted to Minister of Health and Welfare in late 1946-47. And that suited Martin's kind of liberal, small L, propensities to a T. Saint Laurent came from a very different tradition. I mean, Saint Laurent came from the kind of Quebec Catholic establishment. He was a business lawyer. He was older, so he was kind and considerate to Martin. There were lots of birthday notes and everything else, but he was very much a conservative liberal, and so Martin found it very frustrating to deal with Saint Laurent. Saint Laurent opposed Martin, for instance, over health care grants, which were grants to the provinces and the hospitals for health care services that were kind of a precursor to Medicare. Mm-hmm. In the late 1940s, Saint Laurent was skeptical of those. There was some skepticism around pensions. There was skepticism around health insurance in the late 1950s. So it was not an unpleasant relationship or an unhappy relationship, but the two men certainly didn't see eye to eye, and there was moments of kind of tension and frustration there.
And was 1958 when he ran for the Liberal leadership, was that the closest that he got to it?
Well, in terms of an actual contest, yes, there were only two candidates, and he placed second, and that was the closest. But he was at the peak of his influence and power as a politician within the Liberal Party in about 1965-66.
Mm.
He was seen as the hands-down favorite to succeed Pearson at that point. He was miles ahead of everybody else. All the polls, if you look at the poll figures at the time, committed supporters, he was getting 4 or 5 times what the other people were getting. You know, the other potential candidates were getting 2, 3, 4%, and Martin was getting, in the high teens, early 20s. So he was he was extremely influential, and Pearson was bogged down in a series of scandals and minority governments and everything else. So that was it. So it really was. He was closest at that point. I think had Pearson, say, stepped aside in July of 1966, Paul Martin might well have been prime minister.
Yeah, and I guess in 1958, Pearson had just won the Nobel Peace Prize and sort of eclipsed him there, and then in 1968, of course, Trudeau-mania eclipsed him there, and by that time he was yesterday's man, I suppose.
Well, I mean, I think timing is everything.
Yeah.
And, in this case, Martin was not a particularly old man. In 1968, he was just 65. So he was much younger than, Mike Pearson. He was younger than Saint Laurent. 65 today, we don't consider that very old. But in 1968, we didn't trust anybody over the age of 30.
Right.
Martin looked very, very old all of a sudden. And if you ever have an opportunity to look at photos of student radicals in the 1960s, there they go up through the mid-1960s. They're dressed very conservative, short haircuts, suits and ties, and then suddenly, these were young people that Martin could understand. He liked to deal with youth, and he always had time for youth, and he was very active in speaking to university clubs, United Nations societies on university campuses, all the rest of that. He was one of the leading speakers in the Liberal Party like that. And he got along with these young people, But if you look at them, they're still kind of rooted in the 1960s and very conservative in their presentation, less so in their outlook. But and then suddenly in 66, 67, you get the Summer of Love, and it all shifts just as Martin reaches for the brass ring.
Yeah, and then you see the film of the Liberal Convention of 1968, and he's sitting there with the cigar in his mouth and looking, looking like, you know,
well, he looks exactly like an old Paul.
Exactly, yeah. He also thought that if Kennedy had not come to power in the 60s, there would not have been a Trudeau.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, he's very much, Paul Martin was very much like Diefenbaker. He instinctively distrusted Kennedy. Martin and Diefenbaker, who were friendly, though they were political rivals. Diefenbaker, of course, was the conservative prime minister and leader for many of those years.
Right.
You know, they distrusted Kennedy, and Martin thought, and his record makes it clear, even in the 1960s, he thought Kennedy was a hypocrite and a risk taker, you know, he thought it was all image. He was projecting an image of young dynamism, and that's what set off, in Martin's view, that's what set off the whole kind of search for Camelot and the youth movement in the United States, and of course that produced Trudeau and the youth movement in Canada. So he always resented Kennedy.
Did he get along better with LBJ?
Martin loved LBJ.
Yeah.
I mean, even though, you know, Martin had deep, deep reservations about the Vietnam War, he liked LBJ. I mean, it was very much, in some respects, the things about LBJ that turned Mike Pearson off, kind of his roughness, his informality, his homespun sense of humor, his vulgarity, all of those things spoke of the authenticity of LBJ to Martin. Hmm. And you know, Martin saw him as really as an authentic, dynamic, self-made man, and he identified with him. You know, that's the way he saw himself, as an authentic, self-made man.
Did Martin like Pearson?
That's, everybody liked Mike Pearson. Pearson was a very likable guy. So, yes, I think, I think that you could probably say he did like Mike Pearson. That said, he resented Pearson quite a lot. He thought Pearson was disingenuous, the way he portrayed himself as a humble civil servant, of a servant of the people, above politics. Pearson was an intensely political animal. Martin recognized that, and he felt it was really unfair that everybody would characterize him as a politician and as Mike Pearson as this elder statesman, even as Mike Pearson was maneuvering to become prime minister and maneuvering to become leader of the Liberal Party in the 1950s. He resented the idea that Mike Pearson was the intellectual while he was not. And Paul Martin was a very smart guy and very well-educated guy. You know, he had a master's from U of T in philosophy. He uh-huh. had a master's in law from Harvard, and he went to graduate school at Cambridge. So he was a sharp guy. And Paul Martin, he read voraciously his entire life, and not potboilers. He used to tease his staff and his diplomats. You know, they get on a plane for a trip across Canada, and they'd all be carrying the latest Mickey Spillane or something like that. And Martin would have the latest, the latest textbook on international relations or international law, and he used to tease these guys for reading this trashy stuff while he read solid books. And it's true. He did read solid material. He was a very, very sharp guy and a very, very thoughtful guy.
If you had to rank, say, the influence of foreign affairs ministers, a lot of people say that you would put Pearson at the top, say, maybe Joe Clark. Where would you put Martin in that? I mean, is he in that top three, you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think we look back, and there's so much that we forget about what Paul Martin was about. But certainly, I would put him up there. As a foreign minister, I would, you know, put him in the same kind of rank as Pearson. You know, it's hard to come down on individual initiatives and say, well, that makes you number one and that makes you number two. But, you know, Paul Martin played an important role, for instance, in 1952 at the UN in resolving a deadlock over prisoners of war from the Korean War. And resolving that was an important part of moving towards an armistice that settled the war in South Korea, which still is with us today. In 1954, for instance, he was head of the Canadian delegation to a UN disarmament conference that really crafted the very first East-West joint disarmament proposal since 1945. So in the context of the Cold War, this was an important moment of kind of clearing away some of the debris and moving on post-Stalin. It didn't solve the Cold War, but it was an important part of that. 1955, Martin, and this is probably his most important UN accomplishment, but, you know, he's the one that solved the UN deadlock over the admission of new members. Up until 1955, a new member would have to apply to the Security Council to get into the UN. And with the in the context of the Cold War, either the United States or the Soviet Union would veto or had vetoed almost every application. So by 1955, there were a slew of countries, including Japan and the post-war Italy, Ireland, Ceylon, who were all lined up trying to get into the UN. And, and Paul Martin solved that and forced the UN to acknowledge that universality of membership was the principle that should govern the United Nations. And you can argue about whether or not that was wise or not, but it certainly was realistic. And again, in 1964, you know, Paul Martin brokered a UN peacekeeping force for Cyprus. And that UN force is still there today and is still keeping the peace in Cyprus. Again, you can quibble about whether or not that's a good idea or whether or not that's just frozen a bad situation in place, but it's keeping people alive in Cyprus who might not otherwise be alive. And so, you know, you put that whole package together, and he's a pretty significant player.
Yeah, pretty effective foreign minister indeed. How soon, I mean, he foresaw the ambitions of Paul Martin Jr., and could see him as prime minister one day. How early was that, that Paul Martin Sr. saw that in his son?
I mean, certainly it was there by the early 70s. I don't know that Paul Martin Sr. Foresaw that so much as he was aware that his son was interested in a political career, and he was aware that many people within the Liberal Party wanted his son to get into the liberal politics at a pretty young age. And, you know, Martin Sr.'s advice was right against that. He thought that in retrospect, when he looked back at his own career and its frustrated ending, he looked back and he felt that he had joined the Liberal Party in active politics too young. He had spent a lot of time kind of trying to climb up the greasy pole, and it would be much better, he would have been much better served had he been someone like Mike Pearson, who established his credentials outside of politics and was courted to join politics at a senior level. And that's the course of action he urged on his son, and he worried through the 1970s that his son might be tempted too early to join, and it was only towards the end of that decade that he finally began to relax and was prepared to let his son kind of make his own way in whatever world he wanted to go.
And when you look at their political philosophies, their actions, I guess, how different was Senior from Junior?
Oh, dear. Well, I haven't written a book about Junior, so it's tough for me to kind of parse his political, to parse his political philosophy in quite the same way that I understand his father's. But let me say this. I mean, I think they both believe in an active government. And Paul Martin Jr. was dealing with a different set of circumstances. So as finance minister, he had to, he had to rein in the government initially. But I think that if you look at him later on, he seems to have been headed in a much more active kind of trajectory. And I think he probably inherited some of that from his son. From his father, rather.
From his father, yeah. And so, after completing this book and talking about it now as you have, Paul Martin Sr. is a guy that we need to know about, right?
Absolutely. He is one of the architects of the 20th century Canada. And it's the Canada, it's the foundation stones. He laid all the foundations for the Canada we know today. When he was Secretary of State in 1945-46, he's the man who crafted the first real Canadian Citizenship Act. As Health and Welfare Minister in 1950-51, he's the guy who brought in the universal pension, the idea that every Canadian, when they hit 65, or then it was 70, would get a pension. And in the late 1950s, he's the guy who brought in health insurance as the precursor to kind of the full-fledged hospital and health insurance that we have today. So on those three bases alone, his domestic accomplishments, he is laying the foundations of the cornerstone of contemporary Canada.
Indeed, yeah. How is the family, especially the former Prime Minister, Mr. Martin, how have they received the book?
I'm not sure yet. So it's just being launched today, May 13th, so we'll find out. I'm sure in the next little while I'll hear. It was an important project. Paul Martin Jr. lent his support to the project, and I talked to him many times about his father. And having a biography was important for Paul Martin Sr. It was one of the things they really wanted to have done. He wanted a kind of an independent assessment of his life and his career, because he saw that as a sign. He wasn't concerned about being right or wrong. He was concerned about genuinely trying to make a contribution, to be taken seriously. That's what he really wanted, and I think a biography suggests that someone, at least me and the people who read it, did take him seriously.
Indeed. You've written a great book here, Greg, and I've kept you longer than I said I would, but there's so much to talk about this life and this legacy that I've enjoyed the conversation. Congratulations on this book, and good luck with it.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. The book is called Grit, The Life and Politics of Paul Martin Sr. It's from UBC Press. It's author Greg Donohue. He joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joel Suplanta.